Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on Sunday, April 29th, 2018.
Right.
Spring has sprung.
Right.
We're finally seeing a few blossoms. The magnolia tree is out. The weeping cherry tree is out. Next thing you know, we'll be having grass.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to that. Looking forward to that. So, the 8th of April used to mean one thing in sports, which I'll get to in a moment, but now it means something else. And what it means now, believe it or not, is the NFL draft is upon us. The NFL, which is apparently to be beaten into our brains every month of the year. It's not enough that it dominates the fall and winter. It now dominates the spring and maybe in the summer.
Well, I don't know if it dominates the spring.
That was the big story in sports for the past week,
notwithstanding
that they're out of
season. But it hardly dominates our lives.
All right, fair enough. But this is a relatively recent development. It used to be a very small thing. It used to be in a hotel room, and it was like the fantasy drafts that people do now. And people would sit around and say, I'll take this guy. It's now not that way. And you were watching some of the television show, and which was not on ESPN, which was on Channel 5, which was on Fox, on network television, to watch them pick these players. And, of course, a lot of the attention has gone into the biggest names. And I know that you were interested in the story about this fellow.
Well, I always like the human interest stories. And people have been going crazy about Shaquem Griffin.
Yeah, right.
Was drafted by the Seahawks. He's from Central Florida, and at a young age, lost his hand. Okay, right. He was born with a congenital defect, congenital problem.
Right.
In fact, I heard his mother recounting the story of one night he was in such pain. He's like 3 or 4 years old. He sneaked into the kitchen, and she catches him getting a knife out of the drawer to cut his hand
off.
Well,
they ultimately amputated the hand.
Right. And he has a twin brother, Shaquem, who plays for the Seahawks now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a riot. They're a riot together. They've been highly competitive all their lives. Their mom says whether it's eating, running, jumping, whatever it is. And Shaquem was determined to do what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And he actually performed quite well at one of the combines, as I understand it.
Yeah,
it was all over the TV news.
These are two big, strong kids. I mean, if you look at this fellow with the amputated hand and you don't look at his hand or his arm, he just looks like the biggest, strongest person you've seen in your entire life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nimble.
Yeah.
But
there's nothing about him that doesn't look like a football player.
No.
Except he's missing a hand.
And fabulous hair. He has fabulous hair. He's not missing fabulous hair.
Okay, good.
He has fabulous hair.
Yeah. But in any event, he did get drafted, and he got drafted to play on the same team that his brother already plays on. That's the Seattle Seahawks. And we'll see how that works out. You know, he's a defensive player. He's obviously a little bit handicapped by the idea of not being able to tackle as well as some others, but apparently he's successful doing it. And we'll see. But there's another very interesting story that came out of the draft and kind of came at a sideways angle. And I was kind of late to this story, but yet I think I'm still ahead of some other people. And that has to do with a fellow named Kyle Lauletta. Kyle Lauletta was the quarterback of the University of Richmond. University of Richmond is not a big football school. It is a marginal football school.
Okay.
And Kyle Lauletta was a guy who didn't get many offers at a high school, which is why he plays at a marginal football school. He was successful there, but those people don't go to the pros. Kyle Lauletta wrote a letter to be published in something called the Players' Tribune. The Players' Tribune.
Oh, you've talked about that before.
Right. And it's a publication put together initially by Derek Jeter and a few others in which... Players write articles about their situations, about themselves, to speak to the fans, to explain why they're being signing with another team, things like that, all kinds of things. And Lauletta isn't a star, isn't a known name. But he wrote a letter to all the general managers in the league
mm-hmm.
saying, here's why you should hire me to be your quarterback, mm-hmm. if you can believe mm-hmm. it. Which is so crazy, given the way the draft is run and all the analytics and all right. the scouts yeah. and all the money. Yeah. He's applying for a job, as if he's right. writing to the head of you know, of public relations at Procter & Gamble. And he gets the letter published by the Players' Tribune.
Right.
And the letter is, I guess, sort of what you'd expect. The letter says how much he wants to play in the NFL, and he talks about his own qualifications. And he says he understands that he has certain strengths that he feels match up to other folks in terms of reading defenses and the like. And he knows he has some limitations. There are those who doubt he has the necessary arm strength, but he says he can make all the throws, and that's all that matters. And he goes in some detail about his background, including his dad being a player at the Naval Academy, who never started, was a substitute quarterback, who was drilling Kyle his whole life. In any event, then he summarizes the situation by saying that, look, I know my own strengths, and like I said, I try to be aware of my own weaknesses. I know it's going to take a lot of work, but I'm ready to get going. I'm tired of reading about how other quarterbacks are better than I am. I'm tired of being overlooked. I know I'll adjust to the speed of the NFL. I know I'll learn how to read complicated defenses. Whatever it takes to play in this league, I'll do. And I'll keep doing it, because the one thing every great quarterback has in common is that they're always getting better. Okay, well, that's an odd way to apply for a job in the NFL.
Right.
So they go to the real draft, and the real draft is all focused on the first few players. And the first few players, and it's been getting a lot of press in New York, is who the Giants are going to draft as much as anything, because the Giants have an aging quarterback. He's 37 years old. They have the second pick in the draft. Are they going to pick his successor?
Yeah.
Who's going to be the successor to Eli Manning? And the Giants don't pick a quarterback. Mm-hmm. They pick Saquon Barkley, who is a great running back. And they say to the press, we don't feel the need to pick the successor to Eli Manning. We think he has a couple of years left.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, that doesn't make any sense, but okay, it's a great running back. And then the Jets pick Sam Darnold, who is a quarterback with great promise from USC.
Okay.
And the draft goes on. And that becomes a story for a while. And they say, well, this is the way, the kind of decisions you make. You go running back, you go quarterback. And let's think about what the logic behind the Giants' choice. And that's true of day one, and that's true of day two. And then you get to day three, and you get to the fifth round. And the Giants' pick in the fifth round is, guess who? Kyle Lauletta.
Okay.
The Giants take the kid from the Players' Tribune.
So why did they do that?
Well, what the Giants say is, you know something? He can make all the throws.
He can make all the throws.
Yes.
But they didn't know that until he wrote a letter saying, guess what, I can make the throws.
I don't know. I mean, they had run into him. They were familiar with him. He had played in some All-Star games. But you have this odd situation in which, even though the big story is Giants picking running back Barkley versus quarterback Sam Darnold, but the real story is the Giants saying to themselves, you know something, who knows who's going to be the successful quarterback? It's not necessarily going to be the big stud from USC, Sam Darnold at number three. It could be Kyle Lauletta, the Navy coach's kid, down in the fifth round.
Also, it's not a big risk.
He could. It's not
like they sacrificed a important.
I have a funny feeling, though. Look, but you know, it's more than that. I think they believe in this kid. Let me put it to you this way: the guy who's taken first is not necessarily the best quarterback. You can go to Aaron Rodgers, who was taken at 24. You can go to Joe Montana, who was taken at 40. You can go to Tom Brady, who's taken at 199.
199?
You just don't know.
Okay.
And maybe Kyle Lauletta, the kid who wrote on the Players' Tribune that he's the one that should be taken, is going to be the guy. If it's so, the Giants and the Jets will be talking about this for the next 10 years.
Okay, well, that's pretty interesting.
It is.
And you excited about the Giants running back, too, or not?
Oh, he'll be a star. There's no question he'll be a star. The people who have disputed that pick have not disputed that he'll be a star. They're just disputing whether you have to take a quarterback.
Okay.
So right. He'll be great.
No. Interesting. Not the most riveting television, but...
Listen, the NFL has one thing going for it. They sell optimism. And the Giants, notwithstanding they were 3-13, have all their fans believing they're going to the Super Bowl next year.
All right.
That's what
Go
it is.
Big Blue.
Exactly. So in any event, spring, dear. Gardening.
As I said, spring has sprung here. And so thoughts turn to a young girl's fancy of gardening.
Really? That's what yes. That's the kind of young girl in other words, a young man looks for, is the one who's into gardening.
In other words, I've been walking around the yard saying, oh my God, mm-hmm. how are we going to fix this? You know, all the cleanup
right.
and planting that needs to be done.
Right.
And so I... was interested in an article in the Wall Street Journal with advice based on a visit to a great garden in England, mm-hmm. the Great Dixter Garden. Okay, so great, you know, England's role in fantastic gardens.
Right.
And the author here finishes out by giving you some tips learned at the Great Dixter. And though I just thought I'd quickly share some of those
I can't
tips
wait.
And observations.
I want to know what a young okay. woman's fancy.
And one of the things this writer mentions, Amy Merrick, among the things she learned is that the Great Dixter flouts gardening rules, so she tells us which ones not to worry about. She says native schmative. So you know, native,
no old English expression.
Right. Native plants are all the rage mm-hmm. because like native weeds, which are really native plants, mm-hmm. They thrive and love to be here, are glad to
by
be
definition.
Here, as opposed to fancy schmancy imports who have been brought, you know, from God knows where, bringing all kinds of...
And yet, native schmative, dear.
You're right. Well, that is because, maybe enough is enough. Forget about it. Don't focus on that. Plant whatever you want to plant. Throw in some exotic things that aren't going to really thrive in your locale.
Okay.
Maybe they just live for the season. Consider them an annual. They're not going to survive the winter. Who cares? They will look beautiful, okay?
Okay,
so
good.
Forget about that. Fad of the native schmative. Also, nature abhors numbers. So if you're a gardener, the one thing they always say is plant an odd number of plants. Okay. Three always looks better than two. The eye prefers odd numbers.
Okay.
She says, the feeling at Great Dixter is nature doesn't know about odd and even. Don't count.
Yeah.
Plant whatever quantity works in the space.
Okay.
Forget about that. Third, topple the color wheel. And she advises champion disquieting color combinations and watch Vida Sackville-West, famous for her single-hue gardens in nearby Sissinghurst, roll over in her monochromatic grave. Okay, at Dixter, orange tulips vibrate against sky blue forget-me-nots, blah, 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 blah. And it turns out they're talking all about complementary color selections, which all art history students know enhance in each other. So go for color. Number four is give weeds a chance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably because of what we said before. You know, first of all, you know, not all weeds look bad. You just want to be careful they're not overrunning the nice stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A little chaos is a good thing.
Okay.
In any garden. And then finally, she says, aim high in front. You know how you always put the tall plants in the back? She says, not necessarily.
All right.
You know, maybe a couple tall plants in the front will, you know, accent, give some interest, break things up a little bit.
All right.
So there you have
I look forward
tips from Tammy.
I look forward to the results.
On the garden.
I'm not seeing anything yet, but I know it's early. I know you're going to be out there soon making this happen. I'll hold you to this. All right. So I mentioned earlier that usually you don't associate the end of April with football, but with something else. Well, here's the something else. It's the Kentucky Derby.
The Kentucky Derby.
The first Saturday
in
May.
Do you have your bonnet?
Well, here's the thing. Yes. Let me just take a half step back. The Kentucky Derby used to be a big deal. Maybe it's a big deal still, but it was a much bigger deal because horse racing was a big deal.
I think we've actually had Kentucky Derby watch parties.
Yeah, we have.
And it used to be a fairly normal thing. You would see people having festivities.
But people, even more than that.
Random people who don't care about horse racing.
But you would have people talking about who was going to win the Derby for weeks before the Derby.
Yeah.
Now you can't find an article about the Derby in the newspaper. The Derby's going to be 6 days from now. There's no information about it. You know what there's information about? the hats, which is, as you mentioned a moment ago, the hats. The Times has an article called Derby Fabulous Hats, Fresh from the City. So, okay, anything...
Not in the sports section.
Not in the sports section, the hat section. You go, well, I guess it's in the metropolitan section. You say, well, gee, okay, I can't get anything about the Derby except for this. I'll read this. It's about hats. It's about Christine A. Moore Millinery, which is on 34th Street in Manhattan. And it turns out that this millinery shop is the, quote, featured milliner of the 144th Kentucky Derby. The first time that Churchill Downs has bestowed the title. They're the official hat maker for the Kentucky Derby
near Penn Station. That Churchill Downs is desperate.
I don't know. There's a lot of enthusiasm in this article about hats.
And there's a lot of demand.
The people are buying hats. They say there are two kinds of hats they're making. Hats for the Derby and hats for after the Derby. And they're putting aside.
You're wrong about that. There are two kinds of hats. Hats for the Derby and hats for the royal wedding.
That may be too.
That's the only other time anyone wears a hat.
The royal wedding is not mentioned in this.
We're all going to be sitting in our living rooms watching.
When's the royal wedding?
It's like May 19th.
All right, you got time. You can get down to Christine Moore's for that.
For your fascinator.
Yeah, if that's what it's called. But in any event, they have this article about the hats for the Derby, and they're quoting people, including a woman named Patty Effington from Shelbyville, Kentucky, who gives them a theme every year. So she is the largest hat at the Kentucky Derby. She's 64. She says, every year, the milliners amaze me. It's hard to have the hats fit just right, but theirs do. And she doesn't just wear them to the Derby. She says she wears the hat to church the next day. So it's very versatile. They'll have 100,000 people at the Derby and Churchill Downs, but still nothing about horses. So let me fill you in, because no one else is writing about it.
Who are you betting on in the race?
The winner of the Kentucky Derby. Okay,
here you go. I'm writing this down.
Write this down. But let me give you this point before I get to that. All right? This caveat.
Wait a minute. I was all excited.
Keep a pencil in your hand. The caveat is this. You can't pick the winner of the Kentucky Derby, really. And the reason is there are too many horses in the race. There are 20 horses in the race.
Right.
The track doesn't have room for that. So it's a little bit like the Belt Parkway. And the winner of the race has to have what's called racing luck. They have to make sure nobody runs in front of them or bumps into them. And that's very hard to pick. All this tells you is you don't pick the favorite when you bet the Kentucky Derby because it's not worth it. You pick someone off favorite.
Okay.
Our pick is a horse named Mendelssohn.
Mendelssohn?
Mendelssohn.
Okay.
Mendelssohn, which sounds like an Eastern European writer of classical music. But no, Mendelssohn, who has a mixed background, has raced in Kentucky, has some European roots, has an Irish trainer, has grown up racing on turf, which is European, as well as dirt, and has a decent but not great record in terms of winning races, but has one thing going for him. There's something called speed rating. They put some kind of metric on every single race to see the top speed reached by the horses.
Mm-hmm.
That horse is the highest speed rating of any horse in the race, which means on his best day, if he doesn't run into traffic, Mendelssohn will win. Now, Mendelssohn...
Why isn't he the favorite?
Because horses don't always have their best day, and on average, he's not that horse. But he's not that experienced, or all kinds of things. But he will be in the running, as they say. And he will be the third or fourth pick, probably. And that's our pick. It's Mendelssohn. So bet the farm on Mendelssohn. Yes.
Really? And yeah. All right. What if he gets more popular?
Bet the farm.
And it becomes the...
I can't control that. I can only tell you he's going to win.
And does it matter about weather? Are we worried about the weather?
I don't have that. Yes.
Is he a mutter?
We're not giving that kind of granular information.
Okay.
If you want granular information,
yes. Go elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Abuhoff does not have granular Kentucky Derby
information. Not 6 days before the race, though. All right, let's get into bigger issues, like the biggest night migration in the history of the world takes place where, Tebson?
In the ocean.
In the ocean.
Okay.
So you didn't know. That's sort of a trick question you can spring on people.
This is from an article in the New York Times a few days ago called What a Scientist Learned from Studying the Synchronized Swimming of Sea Monkeys. Okay. So this really is about the experiments or the studies of John Dabiri. He's not an oceanographer. He's not a biologist, but he's been studying tiny shrimp swimming through the water, okay? His studies came to the notice of Tom Coburn, In 2014, a Republican senator from Oklahoma, mm-hmm. who listed it in his waste book, mm-hmm. government spending waste book, and dismissed his work as the study of synchronized swimming for sea monkeys. Mm-hmm. But DeBeer is an engineering professor, and here's the deal. Every night, trillions of sea creatures, whales, jellyfish, swarms of shrimp and plankton, take part in what some call the largest mass migration on the planet. From the depths of at least 2,000 feet, they all swim to the Earth's surface in a wave of animals that propagates as the sun sets around the planet. By daylight, they return below.
That is scary. They're coming
it's
for
kind
us.
Kind of fascinating.
They're coming for us.
No, they're not coming for us. They just go up and then they go back down.
Well, they haven't figured out how to get out yet.
The question is, does this have any effect? Does it do anything?
It's crazy when you think about it, though. Who knew this? Okay. Who knew this?
Well, I think a lot of people knew it, but not us.
Nobody in Oklahoma, apparently. Yeah.
Probably Harry and Kathy Easton know it.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe.
But anyway, so the question is, you know, what does it do? Does it help?
The question is, what are we
going to
do about
the
this?
The ocean?
What are we going to do to stop this?
Well, Mr. DeBeer is studying, you know, teeny weeny brine shrimp and how they move. When one brine shrimp moves in the water, it doesn't make much of a stir.
You'd hope not.
But you get a whole bunch and you actually, you know, get quite an effect.
Yeah.
So it's true. He needs to study, you know, the real fishes in the real ocean, et cetera. But it could tell us a lot about how, you know.
I'm alarmed. I'm in. Whatever money it takes to fund this study, I'm right behind.
Okay, but Mr. Coburn was still pretty mean about, even when somebody explained to him the real value of this, he just says, that's a cute story, but to me it's meaningless.
I think it's
what a poop.
It probably is meaningless. Yeah. Well, listen, I it's hard to follow that story. I was just going to say something about the Mets, but that's so inconsequential.
Speaking of sea monkeys, wait a minute, did you ever get sea monkeys when you were little?
No.
I remember you would... It
sounds
would be
like
in
a
the
disease.
Back, no,
yeah.
It would be in the back of like...
Oh, you mean in your aquarium
books.
Or something?
No, the comic... You know, it would say... you could send away for these amazing sea monkeys.
We might have been reading different comic books.
And you get this little package.
They're
and
plastic,
this little,
right?
You get like a little envelope of dry stuff and put it in the water and it would turn into... You know, the pictures were quite adorable. These monkeys that would swim around. And it was really just, you know, brine shrimp, I guess.
Oh, really?
But you didn't have that?
No. They were. I'll tell you later what they were advertising. But in any event, it wasn't sea monkeys. But you're right. Sea monkeys thus take us to the Mets. And the Mets, there's a big article. Times Magazine section has a big article about the Mets' new manager, Mickey Callaway. And it's kind of a rambling article because they don't, I don't know, it probably was written some weeks ago.
When the Mets were winning?
Yeah, exactly. So it was true then, is no longer true now, and it's not, you know, Times doesn't know anything about sports anyway, and it's kind of a little
Times
bit
of always forefront.
Somebody said, are we going to publish this article or not? And they said, yeah, we'll just write the last few paragraphs again. So, but it's about Mickey Callaway, who's the Mets manager, and they do make a couple points that are worth thinking about. They tell the story about how Mickey Callaway came to be highly regarded and why he was hired by the Mets, which is kind of known. He's a little more analytics and oriented than some of the previous candidates, and he's supposed to be a great communicator. They do make him out to be a great thinker. He wrote a 7,000-page treatise on what he would do as manager.
7,000
pages? Oh, excuse me, 7,000 word.
Okay, 7,000-word treatise. 7,000 pages.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah. And apparently he's read a book called Carol Dweck's Mindset, which they find highly intellectual. I don't know the book, but also marks him as a deep thinker. You have to realize...
Whose mindset?
A woman named Carol Dweck. The real point is that, there, you know, it's like football, too. There's baseball genius and there's real genius. They're two different things, okay? So to be considered thoughtful...
I have a feeling you revere baseball genius above all.
No, just the opposite. Okay. It's a much lower threshold. But he's a reasonable guy, and I don't think they're going to help him by heaping on too great expectations. They make a couple of interesting observations. They do say, and this is a quote, while you have the other managers, there are many new managers this year, and usually they're in situations that they're either going to succeed or there are situations where everyone knows they're not going to succeed, so there's no pressure. It said, but the Mets are an awkward hybrid of a team that is coming off a terrible season yet somehow carries high expectations. And I think there's something to that, and I think that's a problem. And I think it's going to be a problem for Callaway, although I think he's got a pretty long rope. But he's going to have trouble succeeding with this team. And they point out two things. Most of the article was written with this in mind, and here's where the change had to come in. There are two players that Mickey Callaway was going to make better than ever. One is Cespedes, the great slugger, and the other was Matt Harvey. And the article is written in such a way that he's off to a great start. The magic of Callaway, they're both going great. And in fact, they're both not going great now. With the article acknowledges in the last few paragraphs, Cespedes is terribly up and down. But of course, as you know, Tamsin, Matt Harvey has been a real problem. And notwithstanding the article would have liked to tell the story that Mickey Callaway was able to turn him around, that's not happening. So I think it's kind of unfair to expect Callaway to be a miracle worker. I think it's more realistic to say that he's going to be very helpful with the pitching. He was a pitching coach, and over a couple of years, they'll improve. But I think Callaway's kind of in a tough spot. There was an article, too, but the one guy who's done very well is a guy named Gazelman, Robert Gazelman, who's excelled in the bullpen. But the Times had an article unrelated to this one to say that the reason is that he's learned to sit up straight when he plays video games. And if you're wondering what
I've seen Gazelman pitch.
Yeah.
And he went to a Mets game. Was it last year?
Yeah, but he's very much better posture now. You wouldn't recognize him.
All right.
And
well,
apparently
there
it helps
you have
his
it.
Curveball.
I do like that characterizing the Mets as an awkward hybrid.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sums up a lot for me.
Oh, all right. Well, we can discuss that later, too. But go ahead. You were going to talk about David Ives?
Yeah, I think I was going to talk about it. But you know what I want to say first is there's a great photo essay in the New York Times this weekend about the summer of 78.
Right. Well, we were in Manhattan.
There was a strike, a newspaper strike. Newspaper photographers strike or something. There was some kind of strike, and photographers weren't doing anything. And the Parks Department hires photographers to go around and take all these shots of what's going on in and around the parks at that time. And there's an exhibition of around 65 of these photographs in the arsenal in Central Park. And I was just saying that was that's when we had just gotten out of college and we're in New York City, and it's very evocative for me looking at these pictures. Seems very much like Central Park at the time. In fact, right around now in April, just after I finished my thesis in at Princeton, they had record temperatures in the 90s, and I remember sitting in Central Park.
Right.
This time of year in New York City, where there's that odd disconnect of bare branches and bare-chested people sunning. But anyway, it's a great essay, and it is the byline is Jim Dwyer again.
Okay.
So anyway, moving right along, Times does a review of another David Ives translaptation.
Don't be afraid to use the word. Translaptation is what he says.
So he has taken an old French farce and he's updated it and translated it. Yeah. And this one is called The Metromaniacs. Mm-hmm. It's his third, the first two being The Liar and Heir Apparent, which were staged at Classic Stage Company. We saw The Liar. It was terrific. Mm-hmm. It was great fun. And this one, apparently not so much. It's based on an obscure play from 1738 that refers to a poetry craze sweeping Paris. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a great translation, reviewer Jesse Green says, and talks about the verse. Says, these verses tickle the ear, a lovely sensation, but being tickled on precisely the same patch of skin, in exactly the same rhythm, five beats to a line for 2,000 lines, is eventually deadening.
Yeah.
So it's kind of too much of a good thing. But if you're into this and you love David Ives, and we do love David Ives, it's going to be at the Duke on 42nd Street through May 26th.
Yeah, so we thought it was interesting in the article, too, though.
That's a good point, yes.
They do have something there. about David Ives being involved in Encores. Now, we go to Encores, which is...
In discussing what a great, you know, guy he is, how experienced he is, and the great things he's done.
And he's great at adapting things. And Encores is the City Center series in which they take three plays from some time ago, musical plays, and they put on weekend performances. And in some way, they adapt them a little bit to make them fit a concert performance.
Right.
And apparently... For 18 years, we had no idea David Ives had been writing those adaptations.
Apparently 33 of them.
Right, really?
He is quite a guy. Hats off to David Ives once again. Now, as opposed to, you know, no hats off for you who made me sit through the Meyerowitz stories.
Well, before we get to that, I should say something about Classic States, because we were at the Classic States Gala. Last week, Classic States had staged the Ives, Venus and Fur, and the Lyre, and we were there. They had a nice gala.
It was not at their theater. It was at the Bohemian National Hall.
Really,
on East 73rd Street.
It's an interesting
place. Lovely venue.
It wasn't
okay, and the little admonitions in the ladies' room of what to do with your trash. Was in English and Slovenian.
Really?
Yes. So that was kind of fun.
That's useful.
But we were in a lovely kind of ballroom with a stage and a balcony.
And they honored John Doyle, the artistic director, and Lynn Angleson, who's the chairwoman. And they had performances, including notably by Cynthia Erivo, who sort of brought the house down. So it was a nice event.
She got a Tony for that
Color Purple,
which John Doyle
revival.
Directed.
Yeah, John Doyle directed that. She was fantastic. Yeah, it was like she just walked into the room, and the other performances were good too, including from Pacific Overtures, which they had put on. But
lots of good performances, a very nice crowd, very positive, encouraging, fundraising crowd.
Right.
It was great.
Right, so we enjoyed that. And that was this Monday. We look forward to going to Classic States in their next performance. Summer and Smoke will be.
And you know what was fun? We had Sadie there with us.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was funny to run into other people you knew also having their grown-up children there with them. And the Borowitzes, the Fishbines.
Yeah. I think about that.
And so you just got to hope that this next generation will be inspired to be interested in the theater.
I think about that. Yeah.
The way we are.
Good point. So, Tams is right. So, we sat through the Meyerowitz stories, which
I'm not even sure how I stayed awake.
But you did.
So I never stay awake.
Okay, so you did. So, that tells us something. So, in any event, Meyerowitz Stories is a film, a movie that was put together by, directed by Noah Baumbach, that was released in the fall, and it was almost straight to video. It was released in theaters. But almost simultaneously was released on Netflix, which was kind of unusual. And it was very well reviewed, or pretty well reviewed. And it has a big cast in it, right? So it is Dustin Hoffman.
You mean a star-studded cast.
Yeah, star-studded cast. It is Dustin Hoffman. It is Emma Thompson. Ben Stiller. Adam Sandler. All kinds of people, right? It's not any good. It's kind of stunning how bad it is, really. I mean, we were watching it. The production values are high. It's very literate. The cast is the cast. And you keep expecting it to at least show some insight with respect to the characters and situation in such a way that it would hold your interest, perhaps do a little bit more. And it just misses. And it just doesn't. And I know Baumbach's always been a little bit on the edge. He writes characters in a fairly unsympathetic way. It's a very inside Manhattan approach to things. Squid and the Whale is his. Francis Ha is his. He's the other half of the Greta Gerwig couple. He's always talking about denizens of the Upper East Side who seems just a few bricks load of a human being. But on the other hand, he always seems to have some appreciation about them, or at least been able to surround them with some kind of humor and recognition of the situation or the absurdity of it. And that's all missing here.
Yeah.
And as a result, you just get characters who are unsympathetic, but you're not sure the director understands how unsympathetic they are.
Well, he does kind of beat you over the head with the characters. Mm-hmm. I mean...
it's very repetitive.
The Dustin Hoffman character is just over and over
again. Well, I figured out what the Dustin character is, okay?
What?
It's the character he played in Rain Man grown up. In other words, in Rain Man, he's autistic. And he just keeps talking in a way that he doesn't relate to anybody or make eye contact. He's just kind of talking. And here he's almost autistic about himself. He just keeps talking on message about his career, his disappointments, his thinking, and he never connects with any other human being. And he almost seems an automaton sometimes.
It's well, he just seems like an incredibly, you know,
self-absorbed
yeah, person.
Yeah, it seems impossible, unsympathetic and difficult. The only thing they hit right was the difficulty of dealing with hospitals, especially with older patients. That's true. In any event, so that was a disappointment. But there is one show that we're watching on television that just we'll give brief mention to, because we are suddenly loyal viewers, and that's a show called...
We are besotted with Killing Eve. Boy. And this is just odd, because I'm not the biggest fan of violence. You know, it's not even an ethical stance on my part. It's just I can't deal. And yet this is a pretty violent show. It's about a female assassin. And this sort of undercover spy, Sandra Oh, who is tracking her down.
Right.
And it's oddly compelling.
Takes place in Europe.
Yes, well, maybe that's part of it.
No. I think it's very compelling. I'm with you, Tim. It's not the series that we normally go for. And somehow it draws you in, but not by being heavy-handed. It's odd. So we've screened three or four. We're scheduling our entire lives around it. It's on Sunday.
It's on an odd time for us. It's on BBC.
Yeah. It's on 8 o'clock on Sunday night. Now,
yeah.
I'm sure there's some...
Because there's sexual situations.
Yeah, it's on 8
there's
o'clock.
Violence. Right. There's nudity. And yet it's on at 8 o'clock on Sunday?
Well, you know, I suppose that people can watch it whenever they want if they know how to pull up the right services.
Yeah, I know, but it's still, it seems an odd choice.
But in any event, just to balance the Myron experience, Killing Eve, it's worth checking out. So you saw something, you had a story that you described to me as Michelangelo's girlfriend, which I suspect is not exactly what the headline is.
Well, au contraire. So this is a review of a book titled Renaissance Woman by Rami Targoff. And the review is by Cami Brothers. And actually, Ms. Brothers starts out with saying, if anybody knows anything about Vittoria Colonna, it's because of her association with Michelangelo. They exchanged letters. He did some drawings for her kind of later in his life, in his 60s. She's around 50. He's over 60. And, there's always speculation about Michelangelo. Did he love people? Did he hate people? He seemed to have hated people. Was he gay? Was he straight? All this discussion. And so people like to say, yeah, but he had that almost erotic sort of correspondence with Vittoria Colonna. Mm. And the thing is, well, she was a very interesting person. She was a poet. She was from, very big family during this period, Colonna. But her husband dies fairly young. She starts out with poetry to her husband, about her husband, letters to her husband. There's a little speculation about just how deep-seated all this expression is, or is it just pretty based on formula and the times. He dies young, and then she kind of becomes obsessed with religion. After he dies, she actually wants to join a convent. The Pope won't let her, refuses her. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Pope and her brother. And speculation is because they wanted her to get involved in some other marriage for political reasons. Mm-hmm. This is the way political alliances worked mm-hmm. out. Anyway, she doesn't do that. She becomes a, she does a lot of traveling. She has a huge correspondence. She's interested in a fascinating amount of people, Protestant and Catholic or traditional. And also, she writes all this poetry that she won't let anybody publish, okay? And nonetheless, a pirate edition of her poems is published, much to her distress. This creates an immediate fascination for female poets in general. at this time, even though she's pissed off. So anyway, she's a pretty interesting person, and it's supposedly a very well-written book. Sounds pretty tough sledding to me, but if you're interested in Renaissance
women... Yeah, if it's tough sledding to you, how is anyone else going to read it?
I don't know. You know, biographies can be tough, mm-hmm. because biographers are all about the minutiae,
yeah.
and readers, I think, don't need all that minutiae. They just want to know, right. okay, what they do. We don't care exactly what day they did that.
Right. Okay.
The bigger picture, you know, if you're a scholar, it's one thing. If you're a dilettante like me.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I do fascinated to hear anything that's even remotely connected with Michelangelo, so... I'll consider it. So our final piece has to do with cars. Our old buddy, Dan Neal. Dan Neal, who writes the car column for the Wall Street Journal, and I continue to maintain is their best writer, and might even be a deeper thinker than Mickey Callaway. He begins the article, which is about the Aston Martin DB11 Volante. You writing that down?
The DB11 Volante.
Father's Day is coming
okay,
up.
Is this like a fancy Aston Martin, or is this the bargain Aston Martin?
It is. I'll give you the price. I know you're interested. $216,000. That's the base price. The price is tested was $233,000.
So if you want like electric windows and air conditioning.
It would cost more, yeah. You know, if you want the Sirius radio, it's a little bit more. But here's the thing. And it's not that he's unaware of how expensive a car it is, or that there's an issue about expensive cars. He says, look, he knows he has friends who say it's just a car. It gets you from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. He understands that. So he starts by quoting Seneca, or talking about Seneca, right? The Roman orator, who he says was sort of a hypocrite in the sense that he preached Stoicism, but at the same time, he was one of the richest men in the empire. So he's aware of there's some kind of
easy
hypocrisy.
Easy for you to say, Seneca.
Exactly right. So here's the distinction he makes, and you can decide whether you agree to it. He says, look, I agree that it doesn't make any sense to get into an expensive car when it comes to exotic cars whose performance is utterly inaccessible on the street. In other words, if it goes 110, who cares? You can't go 110.
Right.
But truly beautiful street-legal cars are rare. He says, not fast. It is fast, but that's not the point. It's beautiful. As evidence, I give you the Aston Martin's competitive set. The Mercedes Cabriolet, the Ferrari, the Porsche, the Bentley Continental. These are all highly accomplished, desirable automobiles. And I reckon each would be faster than the Aston Martin. But park next to the Aston, they look like Soviet farm equipment. All right? That's his point. He says it's a beautiful car, so much so that you will be head over heels, and anybody on the street who sees you will be head over heels. He says Aston Martin puts lots of quid into the roof. It's a convertible. The 8-layer powered canvas roof that can be raised or lowered while driving is a bid for attention when you're trundling through the town square. The Volante's curvaceous deck lid, integrating the leather-upholstered tonneau and twin-head buttresses, make the DB11's heavy haunches and Coke bottle waist even more explicit. The DB11 is a stunner, a slayer, an aluminized drop of British masculinity. Driving a Volante in the open air is not for the shy because everyone's looking. I know a few motorists raced to catch up when I was driving, hoping to catch a glimpse of the gorgeous footballer or celebrity presenter, and found only a wind-chapped old yank. I'm disappointed, too. But in any event, that's the story. It's he says beauty justifies it. The Aston Martin DB11, $230,000. As I said, Father's Day in just a few weeks. Keep it in mind.
On that note, this is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. We'll be back again next week.
That's right.